Radio, it's time for the Act of Worship, which today comes from Cardiff and is led by the Reverend Dr. Peter Stevenson. Here on Radio 4 FM, we continue our Book of the Week. Chris Stewart reads from his memoir, Last Days of the Bus Club. Never has Chris been more dependent on his neighbour, Domingo, as he tries to get the farm back in working order after the storm.
Things, and indeed sheep, being the way they are, a large part of Domingo's flock had contrived to be on our side of the river when the rain started, and they were about to start lambing. Just after Christmas seemed an odd time to be lambing, and for this Domingo levelled some of the blame at me. For reasons that need not be explained here, we leave the bulls on our ram lambs. When the lambs get big, of course, they're apt to cover any fruity ewe that comes within a mile of them, and Domingo's flock, when on our side of the river, is not above wandering over and spending the day grazing on our land. But as soon as our ram lambs get a whiff of Domingo's ewes, and there's always one on heat, the inevitable happens. To be fair, I think one of his own rams had got to them as well, and as they ought not to have been on my land in the first place, Domingo was inclined not to be too censorious, and I not to feel too racked with guilt. Be that as it may, and whoever the fathers were, the sheep were on the wrong side of the river, and they were lambing. This could have been a disaster. The hillside is teeming with foxes and boar, and they are hungry. Well, foxes and boar are always hungry. A fox will wait for a ewe to lamb, and then kill and eat the lamb as it emerges. I can think of no more vicious cruelty, but that's the way of the wild. Thus it was a matter of some urgency to get Domingo's sheep back into their stable on their own side of the river. 5 days after the rain, the river had abated sufficiently for Domingo to be able to tie a length of string to a stone and throw it across. We've done this so many times before that we hardly give it any thought. With the string, I hauled across a rope, and with the rope, I hauled across a steel cable upon which hung a small bag containing a spanner and half a dozen bulldog clips. I selected a suitable tree, sheathed the end of the cable in a plastic hose to protect the bark, passed it twice around the base of the tree, and then crimped it up with the bulldog clips and wellied them up good and tight with the spanner. Meanwhile, Domingo connected a winch to his end of the cable on the far side of the river. And when I signalled that my end was good and fixed, he wanged the cable up as tight as a string on a fiddle. I have a clip-on pulley and a bosun's chair from the last time we used this contrivance, so I clipped it onto the cable and, with some trepidation, as the river was still raging beneath me like a thing demented, launched myself into space, pulling myself across the gulf hand over hand. If the contraption had failed and I had fallen into the river, I wouldn't have lasted 30 seconds. Such was the force of the water. But everything held together like I knew it would, and in a couple of minutes Domingo was helping me disentangle myself. We spent the rest of the day refining the flying fox, as the device is known, with pulleys and hauling ropes and complicated constructions of driftwood and string to raise the cable to the optimum height. And I thanked destiny, as I have done so many times before, for giving me the extraordinary Domingo as a neighbour and friend. The next day, Domingo secured the services of Manolo to help with the heavy work. Manolo glided blithely across the river, hauled by Domingo and me, with his collie on his lap, and then disappeared up the hill with Domingo. A couple of hours later, they came down with the sheep and shut them in my stable yard. There we trussed them up, tying their legs together with string, and loaded them into our farm car. We drove them to the river and there loaded them three at a time onto a moving platform that Domingo had welded up the previous night. The platform was not a thing of beauty, but as an ad hoc solution to the problem it was nothing short of a masterpiece. It had the necessary strength and was as stable as you could wish for when suspended above a fast-moving river on a single cable. Once loaded onto the platform, the hapless sheep were winched across the river and heaved off on the other side. Domingo untied their legs, and they staggered off, looking a bit dazed, until they found something interesting to eat, and instantly forgot the whole wretched episode. An endearing quality of sheep is that they harbour no grudges, which, for a sheep farmer, is a great convenience. Given the complexity of the operation, it took the whole day to get the 80 or so sheep across to Domingo's side of the river. And the work was hard, because the sheep, shortly due to lamb, were enormously heavy. By the end of the day, we were all exhausted. Now that we could communicate with the outside world, Chloe decided that the period of her confinement was up, and it was high time she got back to society. We had all wallowed in the unexpected quality time with one another. The fire in the hearth through the long evenings, the candlelight glowing on white stone walls, conversation, music, home-cooked food, and some good wine. I am easily pleased, but I imagine that by the end of the week Chloe might have found our homespun entertainments beginning to wear a little thin. So our daughter put the wheels in motion for her escape back to the world over the other side of the river. Domingo had taken the platform off, so I fixed up the bosun's chair again, and in 10 minutes we were all three of us across the river, where some friends had arrived with a borrowed mule to take Chloe and her bags up to the road, the track to the river being now impassable for cars. As we hugged one another goodbye, Bumble, our big white mastine, appeared beside us, battered and bedraggled. I could hardly believe that she had launched herself into the raging water and struggled across for no other reason than that we happened briefly to be on the other side. It was little short of a miracle that she had survived. We looked around, appalled at the possibility that Bumble's little terrier companion, Bao, might have tried the same stunt, because he would immediately have been whipped away by the river. But with great relief we spotted him standing anxiously by the cable on the home bank, watching us with that quizzical tilt of the head with which dogs express bafflement. So Chloe headed off for Granada, and we applied ourselves to the problem of how we were going to persuade Bumble to cross that river again. There was no way we could carry her across on the bosun's chair. We're talking about a 60-kilo wriggling mass of dog here. Anna and I swung ourselves across and called to Bumble, but she wasn't having any of it. She took a look at the river, decided against it, and headed downstream. We followed her, calling and calling. She kept stopping and looking at the river as if assessing where might be a safer spot to cross. In places, you would be battered to death in seconds, and then there were calmer stretches where you just might stand a chance of swimming across before the current hurled you upon the next heap of rocks. She was clearly still exhausted and terrified by her first crossing, and she continued downstream till the river crashed against a cliff and there was no way past, then turned and headed back up, with us still in pursuit on the other bank. There was a spot that looked good, or at any rate less bad. We stopped and concentrated all we could on trying to persuade the pea-brained animal to come across. We shouted into the noise of the water, and we begged, and we cajoled, and we jumped up and down with all the energy we could muster, for darkness was falling now, and not much time remained. Bumble looked at us piteously, tried the river with a toe, and stepped back. We howled. She stepped in again, a little further this time, and was instantly knocked off her feet, disappearing beneath the water. Somehow she righted herself and staggered out on the same side as she had entered. "Let's try walking away," suggested Anna. "She might pluck up courage if she sees us going home." So we did, looking back over our shoulders and calling out as we clambered across the rocks. The pitiful creature gazed at us imploringly as we abandoned her, then hurled herself one more time into the water. We raced back to the bank and howled encouragement. Again she vanished beneath the water, hurled downstream by its awful force. We were quiet for a moment, and then we saw her again, scrabbling with her claws to haul herself onto a flattish rock in the middle of the river. She slipped and half fell, but her desperation saved her, and she heaved herself up and lay limp and exhausted on the rock. The dog was not more than a dozen metres from us now. We watched her in the dying light, panting in a state of dazed terror, letting her rest a little to recover some strength. And then we yelled together and yelled at her to throw herself in just one more time and give it all she'd got and she'd be here. She struggled to her feet and moved to the edge of the rock, but on the wrong side. She seemed about to head back to where she had come from. Anna and I nearly went berserk, screaming our very lungs out. If she got this wrong, she would be done for. The river on the far side of the rock was wider and nastier. She had already done the harder bit, and now it looked like she was going back. "Bumble! You brainless Burke! Over here!" She sniffed the water, stumbled, and unsteadily shuffled round to look at us, frantic with fear. Anna was almost in tears by now, and I was beside myself. And then the wretched dog threw herself into the water towards us. She vanished instantly, dragged under by the current. That awful infinitesimal moment seemed to stretch on and on as we waited to see her head above the water again. But we could see nothing. We stumbled on downriver over the boulders, peering desperately into the gathering gloom and the tumult for some sight of her. But there was nothing. But still we yelled Bumble's name as if resisting the thought that we had had our last sight of her. And then, after 20 or so minutes of this, we stopped. It was dark now. We could barely see the boulders in front of us. We had to accept that she had gone. Another dog down. That's how it is with dogs. They die on you. You have to get over it. And she had had a good innings. I was deeply upset, though. Bumble may have been something of a bimbo, but she was affectionate and dependable. Wherever I went, she'd be with me, thumping that enormous tail of hers, making us laugh with her nonsensical notions and habits. I, Bumble, taken by the river. I put my arm round Anna's shoulders, and we stood there in silence, enveloped by the roaring of the river, as a few more minutes passed. And then, as if by some unspoken agreement, we turned and started to pick our way back up towards the house. By the big eucalyptus tree, we stopped and looked back once more towards the river in the dark. "Well," I said, "at least it was quick. I guess it's not a bad way to go. And she never got incontinent like old dogs do." Anna was silent. I warmed to my theme. "She's a big dog. You don't want a dog that big being incontinent about the place, do you?" I had thought I might try and make Anna laugh, although the conceit was not a particularly funny one, and it was hardly a time for levity. And then I laughed. I laughed and laughed. Because there, pale and sodden in the darkness, was the great bedraggled Burke of a dog, panting and feebly attempting to wag her tail. We threw ourselves upon her. One hell of a dog, that Bumble.
Last Days of the Bus Club was written and read by Chris Stewart and abridged by Pete Nichols. The producer was Karen Rose, and it's a Sweet Talk production for BBC Radio 4. In Woman's Hour, after the news, what does ISIS mean for women? And today is the 60th anniversary of the end of food rationing in Britain. We'll join Jenny in a couple of minutes. And in an hour, the campaign to have a Maharaja's remains exhumed from Suffolk and returned to India in the last wish of a prince. First, Messrs Ince and Cox and the Infinite Monkeys.
Brian, unsurprisingly, I've been reading and I'm confused again. Can you explain all of this talk of gravitational waves in under 10 seconds?
Inflationary cosmology suggesting...
Oh, look, I'll just take it that you can't do it in under 10 seconds, therefore we're going to have to do a new series of the Infinite Monkey Cage.
The Decadal series?
Yes, the 10th series, or in binary.
Second.
Yeah, not so good in binary. Anyway, we've got Ross Noble, Stephen Fry, Katie Brand, Dave Gorman. What scientists have we got on?
Alex Bellos, Lucy Green, Tony Ryan, Kevin Fong, Vicky Neal, Katie Slocum.
And the big question, can science save us?
The magic of numbers.
Well, I hope can science save us is a yes.
Robin Ince and Brian Cox explore the Infinite Monkey Cage. BBC Radio 4, Monday afternoons at 4:30.